Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Katie Lambert.
And I'm Sarah Dowdy.
And we're going to start off with a modified nursery rhyme here. If you're ready, are you ready, Sarah?
I'm ready for it.
Okay. Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 19 whacks. And when she saw what she had done, she gave her father 10.
Wait, that's not much of a nursery rhyme. Well, doesn't even rhyme.
That's because the real rhyme, Sarah, is a lie. It says she gave her mother 40 whacks and gave her father 41. That is not true. And Lizzie Borden is one of the podcast topics that we have always resisted.
We probably get this request maybe more than any other topic. I don't know. I don't want to put one above the other, but it's way, way up there, along with Jack the Ripper, that kind of thing.
But the subject has never interested us much because, you know, here's the story. A woman was accused of brutally murdering her parents and hacking their faces to pieces, but she's acquitted and we still don't know if she really did it. That's the whole story.
And that's kind of your standard nightly news fare. I mean, I hate to say it, but it's something that happens almost every day.
Well, and of course, the story of someone who murders a family member is nothing new. You know, we've got Cain and Abel and Caligula and Drusilla, but we had to rethink our point of view because if so many of you are captivated by this story, there must be a reason why. And we aim to put our prejudices aside and try to find it.
So here we go. Okay, the basics of our case. On August 4th, 1892 in Fall River, Massachusetts, a woman is brutally murdered in her home with a hatchet. Not long after, her husband meets the same fate while he's asleep on a couch in his living room. The main suspect is their 32-year-old daughter, Lizzie Borden, and we have a few possible motives. Money, the father was a very wealthy man, or hatred of the stepmother. Stepmother, that's a crucial part to this story.
Or a combination of the two.
A combination of the two, yeah. So the jury's verdict is acquittal, and that's probably the main reason why people are so fascinated with this story. What really happened? How did Lizzie Borden get acquitted?
So a little family background to start with. Sarah Anthony Morse married Andrew Jackson Borden the Christmas of 1845, and they had 3 children together, Emma, Alice, and Lizzie. Alice died at the age of 2, and Sarah herself died when Lizzie was about 3, so she never got to know her mother. And as Sarah mentioned, Andrew was very wealthy. He owned property. He had holdings in textiles and banking. He directed corporations, and one would imagine that made him an attractive prospect for a husband, and so it did.
Plus, he has two young girls, and so Lizzie's father remarries, and he marries Abby Durfee. And Lizzie was about 5 at the time, and Emma, the older sister, about 14. And according to Lizzie's testimony at the inquest, Emma always called her stepmother Abby, but Lizzie always called her mother until about 5 or 6 years before the murder went down. So make of that what you will. But it seems like this is a woman who she thought of as her mother for most of her life.
And again, later, when the DA, Hosea Knowlton, asked if Lizzie's relationship with her stepmother was cordial, she replied, "It depends upon one's idea of cordiality, perhaps," which isn't exactly the picture of a happy home, but Emma in her trial testimony said that their relationship was cordial and that Lizzie and her father had a very good one. So we're going to give you the outline of if she did it, this is what happened.
Okay, so here's just a basic starting fact. Lizzie and Emma both admitted that they were upset about their father giving one of his properties to Abby and her sister instead of them. They were both older, they're unmarried, and they expected their elderly father would provide for them and set them up for the rest of their life financially. And according to some, there was this rumor that he was going to change his will in favor of his wife, and that might cause a few family problems, I'd say.
So on August 3rd, which was the day before the murders, Lizzie attempted to buy prussic acid, a poison, from pharmacist Eli Bence. And he refused her, but the Bordens and their maid, Bridget Sullivan, all reported feeling sick that day and the next morning.
So, on August 4th, Emma was in Fairhaven, Massachusetts, but there were a few other people around, the maid we just mentioned, Bridget, but also, kind of randomly, the deceased Sarah's brother, John Moore, so Lizzie's
uncle from her
Lizzie's
mom.
Uncle on her mom's side. He's visiting. He had arrived the night before, but he left in the morning to go visit another cousin. So he's not around when the murders go down, but he's there immediately before, and then he comes back, so he's there after.
Andrew Borden, her father, left the house that morning as well to get some business done in town. Abby stayed in the house, and she began doing chores and headed to the guest room to make the bed, you know, put on pillow shams, tidy up. And she asked Bridget to wash the outsides of the windows. So she's in the house. Bridget is outside the house. The only other person who's inside the house is Lizzie Borden.
Okay, so according to Lizzie's story, at this point, Abby received a note from some messenger, we don't know who, calling her to some sick person's home. We don't know the sick person either. And Abby left the house on this errand. But this is where our events are going to start down. Like, if Lizzie did it, here's what happened. So what happened then, if Lizzie did it, is she found Abby on the second floor, hit her from behind with an axe, and then hacked her 18 more times.
And she left the body, she cleaned herself up and the axe. She knew her father probably wouldn't come home for a while. It ended up being an hour and a half. So in the meantime, she did some reading and some ironing and some sewing. You know how
just
you spend the time
chores. Yeah.
Between murders. And when he returned, Bridget unlocked the door for him. And as she did, she heard Lizzie laughing on the second floor landing after she had killed her stepmother.
Right. So Lizzie told Andrew that his wife had received that note and had gone off on that errand. And she settled him down on the couch and tried to convince Bridget to go out of the house. There was supposedly a really good sale on ribbons.
Ribbon sale. Who can resist a ribbon sale?
Entice the maid. But Bridget isn't interested. She instead goes to the attic, probably worn out from all that window washing and her upset stomach from the poison the night before. But
possible poison.
Possible
Sarah.
Poison. So after Lizzie settled her father on the couch, he falls asleep, and then, supposedly, she hits him in the face and head with the axe 10 times, so hard that she snaps the handle off the axe.
But then, in 10 minutes, according to the timeline that the police tried to put together based on what everyone said they were doing that day and Lizzie's own conflicting testimony, she would have had to clean herself off, her clothes, and the murder weapon in 10 minutes. And only
after
then...
After axing someone 10 times.
See, I imagine that would be...
A messy scene?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
And only after this did she call to Bridget for help and announce that her father had died. She didn't say anything about Abby because she thought that Abby had left the house.
She's off on that errand. So... Now we're going to move on to the bodies and the scene, and this is pretty disturbing stuff, but Abby had a 5-inch hole in her skull, and her head and her face were completely unrecognizable. She was lying face down in coagulated blood, and her clothes were soaked in it, and the bed and the pillow sham next to her were all bloody, and the wall and the chair and the bureau all covered in blood. Just a small disturbing detail, her braid had even been hacked off.
And Andrew was on his back on a lounge, his face turned as he slept, and his face and head, too, were no longer recognizable. You can find pictures of the crime scene online if you so desire, which you very well might not. The axe had gone through his cheekbone. It had severed his eye in half. There was blood dripping onto the floor and from the sofa and on the walls, a painting on the wall, the ceiling, the door, and it was still wet and flowing when others entered the scene, which is why we assume that Abby had died first and he had died second. But it seems very personal to attack only a person's face and head to us.
Definitely, and so many times, too. But here's an important detail. The rooms were perfectly in order. There was no sign of a break-in, no sign of a struggle. It seemed likely that whoever did this knew the couple.
And also, the Bordens kept all of their doors locked all of the time, and supposedly this is because there'd been a theft in the home, and perhaps Lizzie had a history of shoplifting, so their house was always on lockdown.
Which paints a rather disturbing scene for the house, too, I'd say.
Make her move out.
And don't think of it just as, like, the front door is locked, like a normal house would be, but all of the rooms and everything just completely locked down all the time.
And if it is all locked, the person probably would have had to be in the house the whole time.
Yeah, exactly. So after the murders, Lizzie called for Bridget after this 10-minute window we have, and then sent Bridget to go get the family doctor, Dr. Bowen. Bridget couldn't find the doctor, or he wasn't there. She comes back without him. And then Lizzie sent her out again, this time to get a family friend, Alice Russell. But in the meantime, their neighbor, Adelaide Churchill, showed up, and she went off for help. So just imagine all of these people sort of coming in and out, but large periods of time where Lizzie is in the house by herself, possibly doing anything.
Dr. Bowen does come to the house finally, and Bridget and Adelaide return, and they're the ones who discover Abby's body upstairs, because of course that police officer asked Lizzie, when's the last time you saw your mother? She said,
oh,
no.
She went off on this
my
errand.
Stepmother. Yeah, and she said she was gone from the house, but the last time she'd seen her was in the guest room. So the maid and their neighbor go upstairs and find Abby's body.
And you can imagine we've already listed all of these people who are at the crime scene. Soon enough, we have more officers, more neighbors and onlookers. Everyone is trampling all over everything. Police are walking through the crime scenes. The evidence, whatever evidence there would have been, is completely contaminated. And Katie just kind of mentioned this.
Yeah.
An officer on the scene asked Lizzie when she had last seen her mother, and she was very careful to say, no, it's my stepmother. And she said her mother died when she was a baby. And this turns out to be a really big piece of evidence, or at least
it keeps coming up.
It's turned into a big piece of evidence. But I don't know how much there is to that.
Maybe she was just trying to be very precise.
Yeah,
with
I mean,
her answer.
Abby is her stepmother, no matter what kind of relationship they had.
So no one thought Lizzie was guilty, and instead all manner of suspicious characters are implicated. Lizzie had mentioned an angry tenant that she'd heard with her father. Others recalled seeing suspicious men near the house recently, including a mysterious Portuguese farmhand who perhaps was the fiendish murderer that ends up not panning out. And another Portuguese guy had recently killed someone in town, so They thought maybe it was him and arrested a different one, so try not to be Portuguese around the Borden murders. But in early newspaper accounts, they said that Lizzie had been in the barn, she came into the house, she saw her father's body, rushed upstairs and found her mother's. And then they recounted any possible theory, this angry tenant, a man who'd been sleeping in the hayloft and planning these murders, someone who was poisoning the family's milk, some kind of trickster who sent Abby this note to try to get her out of the house and commit other sinful deeds and go after Mr. Borden.
Yeah, and the newspapers aren't suggesting Lizzie as the possible murderer at all at this point. According to the Boston Herald, quote, "In Lizzie Borden's life, there is not one unmaidenly nor a single deliberately unkind act." So people were pretty confident it was not this well-bred young woman. It was some sort of dastardly man, preferably a Portuguese farmhand.
Mysterious foreigner.
Just a mysterious man who's briefly in town. It couldn't be Lizzie Borden herself.
But the evidence starts piling up because who else could have done it? According to this timeline and all the other aspects like the locked doors, she was pretty much the only one. And this mysterious man theory begins to seem a little thin.
Lizzie's isn't a good mysterious man around.
No, and she's emerging as the most likely suspect, especially after her inquest testimony. So the inquest was August 9th, and it's Hosea Knowlton questioning her and also Bridget and John Morse and some of the others. And Lizzie continually contradicts herself about times and the sequence of events, and she says some very odd things. She seems confused by the questions and was disquietingly calm.
Yeah, and just a few days later, on the 11th of August, she was arrested and claimed she was not guilty. By August 22nd, there was a preliminary hearing, and at that, the judge said, well, she probably is guilty, and she's going to have to go in front of a grand jury. But the grand jury wouldn't agree to actually meet until they got this just sort of decisive account from Alice Russell. And Alice Russell said, she was the friend and neighbor, remember, she said that she saw Lizzie burning a dress in the kitchen just a few days after the murder. So once the grand jury hears that, they're like, all right.
Here's an indictment.
We better hear what Lizzie has to say.
The trial began June 5th, 1893, and again, some more fabulous newspaper quotes in the Boston Herald. Quote, "Her dark, lustrous eyes, ordinarily flashing, were dimmed, and her pale face was evidence of the physical suffering she was undergoing and had experienced." Poor Lizzie.
Poor Lizzie. So the prosecution was led by Hosea Knowlton and William Moody. The defense led by Andrew Jennings, Melvin Adams, and George Robinson. And Moody told the jury that Lizzie had planned the murders, committed the murders, and then couldn't even keep her story straight. And they hadn't seen a tear from her. You know, she was not reacting as a woman in this position should. She hated her stepmother. She wanted her father's money. That's the story that they were presenting.
But there are plenty of things that Lizzie had going for her, starting with she's this woman of breeding from a good family. She has,
as those newspaper quotes suggest.
Exactly. She had plenty of character recommendations, and not many people thought a woman was capable of hacking someone's face to pieces. You know, poison sounds like a nice feminine way to kill someone, not a hatchet.
And then we have the character references coming in here, too. So her sister and her uncle and the maid all said that she had a good relationship with Andrew and Abby. There was no motive to kill either of them. And then this is sort of the crucial thing. They didn't have the murder weapon.
They have some axes. Of course, there are plenty around if you've got a barn, and they've got one that doesn't have a handle, but there's no blood anywhere on it, and we're missing the handle.
So it could be the axe, but it could just be a broken axe sitting around from farm work.
And we also have no blood on her clothes or her shoes. We have nothing, no blood
so
on Lizzie Borden.
It's not a really great case for the prosecution.
It's all completely circumstantial.
And then this is the killer thing here. Her inquest,
unintended.
Her inquest testimony, which is what, of course, made the judge think she needed to go in front of a grand jury in the first place, was ruled inadmissible in court. And that's because the judge believed that she had been treated as a prisoner instead of as a suspect while she was having her inquest. And
she wasn't just a witness. She was under questioning.
Yeah, and should have had an attorney present. Since she didn't, he didn't think that they could actually take her inquest seriously.
Well, and as a side note, Dr. Bowen had dosed her with morphine before this inquest to keep her calm. But obviously that could have made her kind of loopy. So, I mean, that could explain her contradictory testimony and why everything kind of confused her.
But the prosecution was saying, even in her inquest, she denied everything. There wasn't anything in the inquest.
No confession.
Yeah, she wasn't coerced into confessing to these murders in it because she's all doped up on morphine. If she didn't confess to it, then why couldn't they use it? That was their point.
But the testimony was excluded and also ruled inadmissible was Eli Bentz, the pharmacist, his testimony about her trying to buy poison from him. These are two key points that are missing from that entire trial.
So that loopy inquest and the poison fact, which seems very significant. So there is still a fair amount of evidence against her, though. According to Bridget, the maid, there was no way anyone else could have gotten into the house during the timeline of the day without being seen. And Lizzie was simply the only person who would have had access.
And I also thought it was very strange that Lizzie didn't wonder where her mother went and that she was also in the house and didn't hear her being murdered and falling to the ground. You know, maybe after you come across your father's body, you begin to wonder what happened to your mother.
Yeah, or you would just hear her falling upstairs. But the family may have said that Lizzie and Abby had a pretty okay relationship, but others were testifying, no, Lizzie hated her stepmother. And the family friend, Alice Russell, said that Lizzie had come to her the night before the killings and said, quote, "I feel afraid something is going to happen." So starting to paint a darker picture of Lizzie's psychological state before this.
Lizzie also said that she had been in the barn during the time of her father's homicide, but when officers went to investigate the loft, it was very dusty and there were no footprints but the officer's own, which seemed a little bit strange. And it was also extremely hot in there. She'd claimed to have been there for 30 minutes on this silly errand looking for lead for sinkers, which, again, something's not quite right there.
Yeah, maybe not an errand or a chore you'd do in the middle of the day. And then there's that note, which seems very sketchy indeed. The note that Lizzie said Mrs. Borden received. No one ever found the note. No one ever figured out who the messenger was. No one ever even figured out who the sick person was who needed visiting in the first place. There was a reward offered. Nobody came forward with any news.
And again, her timeline that day made no sense. And the dress Alice saw her burning, she said it had paint on it.
Just doing a little wardrobe cleaning a few days after murder.
Yeah. And it could very well, of course, have been blood. And the dress that she gave the police and said she was wearing that day wasn't the dress she was wearing at all at the time of the murders.
It was silky and kind of a nice dress, not the sort of thing you'd wear.
Not a chore dress.
Around the house. And then Lizzie was eerily calm during the whole trial. According to the New York Times, quote, "The most remarkable feature of the trial has been the demeanor of Lizzie Borden. From start to finish, she has manifested no feeling of weakness and has listened to the recital of the most cold-blooded and shocking details of the crime with a perfectly impassive and unmoved countenance."
I maintain it could have been shock.
Could have been shock. But here we do start to see the papers turn a little bit against her. So she does faint when the skulls of her parents were revealed, but
they consider that a point for her.
Yeah.
There are some rebuttals as far as that whole dusty hayloft thing. There were some men doing work a few days before the murders, and they were like, listen, we were in there, and there are no footprints of ours either, so this is a ridiculous piece of evidence. And also, would a killer be that open about burning a dress in the kitchen? That was the other point. Wouldn't she be sneakier about it?
If you gotta get rid of the dress, you gotta get rid of it.
And again, where's our bloody hatchet? Where's this axe handle that supposedly came off from the force of the blows? How could she wash herself, her clothes, and a murder weapon in about 10 minutes before she called Bridget? Some people were like, maybe she did it naked and that's how, but I mean, come on.
Certainly paints a wilder scene. And then one more final important rebuttal. Andrew was a really rich guy, so it's not too unlikely that somebody might have something against him or want to get money somehow. And then some people did say that they had seen suspicious characters, just nobody they could specifically name hanging around the house right before the murders.
Well, and again, this is all circumstantial evidence, and there is a reasonable doubt. And I think we can all agree, if we were on that jury, we would have thought the same thing. And the judge agreed, and Lizzie was acquitted.
So, picking up with Lizzie's life after the murders, what happens after a trial like this and sensational murders like this?
Emma and Lizzie bought a nice house together in Fall River. Lizzie named it Maplecroft and changed her name to Lizbeth. Emma became very involved in church, but eventually moved out. They had some sort of falling out or argument, possibly because Lizzie had a relationship with an actress, and Emma changed her name as well.
And they died only 9 days apart, which is one of those spooky little...
connected to the end, yeah, in this bizarre little thing.
So there you go, guys. Lizzie Borden episode. And I mean, we've got to think about sort of modern connections to what we see in the news, right?
Well, and why it's so important. I mean, today, like you mentioned earlier, when you're looking at the news, the murder of a child or a spouse or a parent is unfortunately all too common. And after a while, maybe the horror of that stops being so shocking. And maybe it's easier to contemplate a crime like this with the safety that distance provides. You're looking back at it in time. It's not so present. And this has become such a part of American lore that we've got a nursery rhyme about it.
Yeah, Lizzie Borden has become a cult
figure. Not a nursery
figure.
Rhyme, maybe. Just yeah, plain
not,
rhyme.
Not what you sing in the nursery. I know I visited Salem about a year and a half ago, and Lizzie Borden is not from Salem, but there are all these shops with Lizzie Borden memorabilia and, you know, those hologram things where it's this staid portrait of a nice buttoned up Lizzie Borden and then it's like Scary Axe portrait.
Oh, God.
That kind of thing. I think it just, she's a cult figure. She's caught people's attention somehow.
And of course, we're always fascinated by gore and violence, human beings in general, not just Sarah and I, but also by what is unsolved, because, you know, we like to tie up loose ends. We like to find our answers. But in this case, the only real satisfying answer would be for Lizzie Borden to appear right before us and say, yes, I did it.
Perhaps in hologram form.
I hope it would just be the real her, but that's the answer we can't have, and that's what makes it all the more alluring. So if you would like to tell us, all you requesters of Lizzie Borden, exactly why this matters to you, we're still wondering. So you can email us at historypodcast@howstuffworks.com. We're also on Twitter at MistInHistory, and we have a Facebook fan page. And there's an article that might go along with this, How Bloodstain Pattern Analysis Works, that you can find if you search our homepage at www.howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. And be sure to check out the Stuff You Missed in History Class blog on the howstuffworks.com homepage.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.